I had a talent to cut out things off paper with scissors very fast and so. And my relations and so, they liked that very much, and my parents liked that very much. And me being a vain creature, I like to please, you see. And so I came into that. And I remember my first cello theater, which I made. This was in school, when we were having Shakespeare and English lessons and so on. So I made myself a little frame, and at home I made Romeo and Juliet and all that and played it with that. Very primitive, just a little frame with the scenery. I remember the first feeling of what you could do with the puppet's movement was when Julia appeared on the balcony. Romeo was just standing there stretching out his arm, and Julia appeared and had her hand in a position. And then she would lean her chin in her hand whilst Romeo was saying how she puts her chin into her hand, and etc. And there I had the feeling this was grand, that one could do that.
Very theatrical.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I had a great love for the theater. I went to the theater a lot, and so on and so forth. And then I got bitten by films, you see. When I was very young, my grandmother had to go to the cinema with me all the time. They had the Méliès films there and the pantomimes. And my grandmother had to go, and we had a cinema nearby which was run by two old ladies in reform dresses and so. And once there was said there was a film on the Sleeping Beauty, and when my grandmother came with me, that film, the Sleeping Beauty was off. But I began to howl so terribly that these kind old ladies got the film back and showed it to me the next morning. I couldn't bear the idea that this poor child shouldn't see his Sleeping Beauty.
How old were you then?
Oh, I must have been 9 or 10 years or so. Well, actually, far too old to howl like that.
Well, you got bitten by the films, you said.
I got bitten by films, and I wanted to make films, but I came from a family who had neither connection to the theater or to the art world. To the art world, yes. My father was befriended with painters in the Royal Academy there, and on Sundays he used to take me into their studio. And so I got very early acquainted with painting and things, you see. They wanted to keep me quiet, and they gave me colors and let me paint. But this period was not as it is now, where they make all children do this, you see. They, well, nevertheless, I was crazy about films. And there was in Germany a wonderful man called the actor Paul Wegener, who might be known to you as a film pioneer. He is, for my taste, far too little known, for he is responsible also to a great deal of all the development of the in art in the German films, which in this period was very good. And he made all these films with a fantastic element. He wanted to make use of the fantastic possibilities in films. He made The First Student of Prague, where the man meets the picture of his mirror and all that. And I was absolutely tickled by that. And I remember the crucial point was in the year 1915, he did a lecture on this type of film and trick film and all this. And I went to that lecture. I was 14 years old then. And that decided me. I heard for the first time talking about the possibilities of animation and all this kind of thing, the fantastic things in films. And that settled it. So I had nothing in mind but to meet that man, which was for me a very difficult thing. Now, he was an actor at the Reinhardt Theater, so I approached that Reinhardt Theater and tried to go into the acting school, and at least I was near the theater. And this worked very well. Also, I had a very bad voice, as you may well notice. I had a feeling for acting, and so on, so I respected this. And now I wanted to draw the attention of the big people on my little self. And in order to please them, I cut out silhouettes of the actors in action. I was always standing in the wings, which we were strictly forbidden to do in the school, and cut out the silhouettes, which were exceedingly good. And
with your scissors and paper?
With my scissors and paper, but I had a kind of photographic memory, you see. I waited for the moment which struck me as a typical pose, and so. And the actors liked that very much and praised me, of course, much more for the silhouette cutting and so on. And that Wegener was interested in the optical arts, and he had in his house always on Sundays the best people like Pölzig or whoever was in Berlin. On Sunday afternoon, they went to Wegener. And of course, I made of that Wegener many silhouettes and succeeded in drawing his attention to me. And he helped me a great lot. His poor wife had to go to his rich friends and they had to buy my little silhouettes and all that. And he gave me my first film job in the year 1917 or 18, this was. This was to make the titles for the Pied Piper of Hamelne. Mm. And I was 17 years old by then. And they also published a book of my acting silhouettes, which had a very great success. So I stepped into films, and then that kind I pestered that poor man no end. I only understand now how really awful I was. Whenever he had a free moment in his box, half an hour pause, I came there with my drawings and so on. But he was very kind.
This was really the first sort of graphics or animation that was present in the films, actually.
Yes, well, and he then made me meet some people who formed an animated studio for animated films in Berlin, a group of young people. For after the war, there was an inflation, and this was our luck, for people were ready to give some money to experimental artists and so forth. It wasn't very much, it wasn't worth anything the next day. And Wegener got me acquainted with those people who were also his friends. This was the Institute for Kulturforschung in Berlin, Dr. Hans Kürles. And he said to them that silhouette girl, these silhouettes of that girl cry for movement. For heaven's sake, let her do an animated cartoon. She can make her figures movable and we put them on a glass plate and then let it be. And these people let me do it. And this was in the year I made my first animation in 1919. On the 12th of December 1919, I made my first film.
Mm, what a wonderful feeling. What yes. was it?
It was a ballet of just a dance between two people. You see, I had made two people. It was called The Ornament of the Loving Heart. And it was also. And I had also cut out the ornament around those people, and the ornament moved with their dancing and so. And I still have that little figure of there, and I've never made a better one. I haven't improved at all.
That's a very, very private
well,
secret.
Well, I will show it to you, and you will see.
Now, you were making actually shadow puppets then.
Yes, I made shadow puppets with as many joints as I could possibly imagine a puppet should have. And then this was laid on a glass plate with transparent paper on it. Light was put on a lease, camera was put on top and looked down on it. And the figures were cut out of light lead. And then I moved it for every frame of the picture. I moved it on and I noticed I could do it.
Did you move it from underneath?
No.
Just
frame by frame the thing, you see. You mustn't cuff or anything and you mustn't make any awkward movement. But this is easier. Well, you ought to have a talent for that. There are people who never can achieve anything.
It's a very time-consuming process, making someone
Yes, but
dance.
It's exciting, you see, for you never see the movement, actually. You only see the face. And then to have the fantasy, to imagine the movement proper, that is the neck of it.
You had never any studies in anatomy or...
Yes, I went sometimes to evening classes for a short time in a private art school. For there was this man Ernst Stern, who was a famous theater, and he always encouraged me to do so. But I noticed that what you could learn in art school about the eternity was not the right thing for these things. So you have to have a kind of profile fantasy, and you have to transform the anatomy into profile movements. And then you have to study movements a great lot, you see. Each new animal is a problem for these animals, and terrible, they move absolutely different.
How did you study?
Well, I just watched and then I tried to recall this.
No, where did you go to the zoo? And
I went to the zoo, and when I made a horse, I couldn't go through the streets. I was gazing at each horse, as I had get the movement right and proper. But I went to the zoo a great lot, and best I could.
And the human beings that you were a little bit more familiar with?
Well, the human beings I had, this was a training, as I was standing in the wings, you see, with the sharp light of the projector, I got that profile feeling all right.
Now, were you interested in films other than animation, or was this entirely your life at that time?
I was interested in every bit of film. I went to 2 cinemas a day, if I possibly could.
It was a very rich period.
It was a very rich period, and it developed very fast, you see. It was very exciting.
Who were some of the leading people in Berlin at that time?
At that time, this was the coming of Lubitsch, and then there was Fritz Lang, and Pabst, and, quite a galaxy of very, very good people. Lubopik. Not so well-known people who made marvelous films.
Now, did you have any contact with these people, or were you fairly much in your own little territory?
Yes, I got contact with these people, for they all tried that. They were all intrigued by the silhouettes, and I did very often for the big films. I did little interludes and all the things, you see, for Fritz Lang and for Pabst and so on, and also for very... entertaining films, how Tanz Mariette by Selmig, it was a musical, and so I did all sorts of things in between.
Now, when did you do your next feature film, and what was that?
Well, after this Ornament of the Loving Heart, I made the Flying Trunk, the Andersen fairy tale. And then I made A Christmas Story, and then I made Cinderella. And then I did odd things in between, you know, and I helped them with their, they made geographical films. I met my husband there, and we stayed together ever since.
When was that?
Yeah.
When was that, and what was your husband doing then?
My husband was working in that group of young people who had come there, and he was making, art historian, or whatever you call it. He has studied history of art, and he made films of sculptures and things in the museum, putting them on a circle so that they turned round, and so which he thinks they all never had been done before. And then he did, I don't know, but they made also lots of geographical films about the borders and all sorts, quite interesting things. Well, we were all hoping for eternal peace, you see, and tried to find out the reasons why the borders were wrong and so.
And then he started to help you at what period?
We worked together first in this with Dr. Kurles in the Institute for Kulturforschung, and then somebody met a banker there, and he asked me, would I do a full-length silhouette film? And I said, well, I don't think one can do that, and so, but and he said, well, he would be interested to make that, but he wanted to do it for his own, and so this was, of course, an enormous temptation, and then I said, well, we can do the Arabian Nights, this has enough stuff in it, for one has to do fantastic things in this period. And so we went out into his place, and he lived in Potsdam, and he gave us the top of his garage as a studio, and then we went there and started on Prince Ahmed. And we tried to call into that the most interesting, advanced people in animation, which was Walter Ruttmann and Bertolt Bartos and Kardan. And they... worked for backgrounds for magic movements, and so we worked together. He did quite interesting, in this film there are quite interesting bits, sometimes worked on a machinery who worked just this once and never before, you see, for Ruttmann was very inventive, and we did all sorts of interesting things there.
So you were really an inventor in the cinema. you and these other people?
In a way, yes. They always blamed me that I stuck to my poor little silhouettes. I should do much more interesting things, but I loved my puppets. I was not so interested in the background movements and all that. I was interested in the figure of in figures. And I wanted to tell stories with figures, with people.
Were you fond of stories in themselves?
Yes, I was fond of stories in themselves, yes. And I liked always to have stories. And the thing had no story, I was not so interested.
What kind of stories did you really enjoy most, or did you want to tell?
As I want to tell the stories in films and in animated films, which was my only possibility, I tried also to make live things, but wasn't good at that. I liked fantastic things, you see. And then this went with the development of the films, you see. First with the silent film, you could tell stories easily, for you could bridge the action with titles and so, and then show only the mere fantastic happenings in a way. But then when the sound film came, we had the chance that the music the film was intended to was really performed with the film. By the way, for that film, Prince Ahmed, there had been original score composed during the making of the films, and I made various processions or marches or things exactly in the tempo which the music would have. There's also a man playing a flute and so, and we've counted that out in time and made, and then this composition was played with a film.
That then was the beginning of using sound with film, but
yes,
separately.
Yes, but in this case, yes, it was played separately, but we had a very funny score with the pictures of the film put into it, so that the conductor who was conducting the music always knew where he was, and in that very moment, he ought to be there, you see this. And this worked very well.
Prince Ahmed, now, is this one of the stories of the Arabian Nights?
It is a kind of mixture of all the stories. I took the Arabian Nights, read them very carefully, and put all the fantastic things together, you see, the things which were the sorcerer and the witch transforming each other, a tree turning into a monster, and all these fantastic things. I put them all together and then I stirred them around and made the story. So in Prince Ahmed, there's actually two stories. There's the story of Prince Ahmed and the story of Aladdin and the magic lamp, which comes in between. And like in the Arabian Nights, Aladdin comes in the middle of the picture and tells his story to Ahmed. You see. But this happens always in the Arabian Nights fairy stories.
But you didn't mind sort of taking a little bit of advantage of the Arabian Nights. It didn't bother your artistic sense at all to create your own story out of it.
Yes, but I stuck in the actual events. I try to tell them exactly as they are told adorably in these fairy tales, you see. But then I tried to make honest. There's lots of stuff in the Arabian Nights.
Well, now, you can't just have these characters on a white screen and have all the magic come through the movements and the succession of your puppets. Surely the other people, the sets and the lighting and all these other things, are very much important in creating the mood and the fantasy too, or do you not think so?
Oh, yes. There's a big theory, you see, about the real true shadow play. As they say, a shadow play mustn't have any backgrounds. Well, I had backgrounds galore as soon as I could make them, and I had the backgrounds all cut out of transparent paper so that the silhouette movement stood out against them, you see, but it helped the story. It told you where you were and gave you the opportunity of fantastic things. When Ahmed goes with his horse into the sky, we had three layers of stars laid out, and the one moved slower than the other, so that you obtained a real feeling of space. Or when Aladdin with his ship goes over the sea, we created the sea storm out of layers of transparent paper and so on and so forth, and this is very effective.
How long did it take you to make Ahmed?
Well, we had a hold back in this thing, for the inflation stopped while we are making this thing. And then there was a difficulty to get that financier to go on with the thing to the very end, in spite of there was no inflation. But we overcame that. But altogether, it took us nearly 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And you were financed by this nice banker?
By this nice banker, yes.
You were talking about the theory of shadow plays or shadow puppets. Where does it spring from, and what is the origin, as far as you know?
Well, the origin, as far as I know, is China, where the court people had, the emperors had their shadow plays, and they had their artists who cut out shadow plays for them, like European princes would have their opera houses in each town and so on. And I think Marco Polo was the first to bring the news over here. There's this Chinese theory. I think this is the oldest. There are lots of theories with Rari. And then you have the Javanese, which also are very old. And I think, but I do honestly think that this came over to Java from China. But it's quite a different style of shadow play. The Chinese puppets are moved in sticks and pressed against the screen in a, what is this? This is a vertical, in a vertical way. And the stick of the manipulator really conducts the movements. Whilst the Javanese things, the puppets are more, what should I say, religious, you see. They are more abstract. They move with sticks, with quite visible sticks on their hands and so, and are moved from underneath. And they always tell the same story, the Ramayana or some such. And the puppets play there are quite of a religious festival, as we would have. Well, the Chinese figures differ, you see. You have very big Chinese figures and also just about that size and so. But whilst the Chinese things have more folklore in them and tell funny stories, and also they have ghosts and things there. It's a different thing. Whilst the Javanese are far more traditional. They are quite outstanding in their style.
Have you been influenced by either of these, do you think?
Yes, actually, but when I started my thing, I hadn't heard of them. I later then, of course, watched them with interest in the museum when I was doing the shadow things. I certainly one is influenced by everything one sees, you see. And then there is another strong line of shadow playing. It was in Egypt and in Turkey and Greece, where until nowadays this is a very popular entertainment. And I made a pilgrimage to Greece to find the Karakoş Theater of Molas there. And this was a very, very good experience. This was wonderful.
Are these traditional shadow puppeteers that keep going through?
Yes, well, but there it's really a folk art. The shadow play, when I sat in the hotel, I wanted to go to see the Karakoş and said, oh, no, you can't go there. You see, it was considered to be a very low entertainment. When I come there, I found a cafe full of sailors and so, a real folk thing. And the Karakoş plays obviously were fairly rude. I didn't understand any Greek, but by the kind of laughter which they evoked in the audience, I could guess that they were sometimes saying the thing. And also they were as obvious as Greek vase paintings. Né? They are direct descendant from that, you see.
And these are handled behind a screen?
Behind a big screen in the Chinese way, also with a vertical support, and on a very long screen. They like making processions, and Molas is there, his whole family, all his children and grandchildren walk along with those figures, and the figures are real folk art. Now they are using more cinnamoid and modern stuff, which are not as good as the old parchment, which is more primitive, which made them look much more characterful.
Have you changed in the materials that you've used from the early days of Ahmed?
No. I had always for the, this was very practical. I first cut out my figures merely of thin lead to make them lay heavy on the paper so that they didn't make any unexpected movement. But then I found out that a combination of cardboard and lead would be better, you see, so that the figure would follow your indications more easily. You see, it's difficult to explain that.
And you manipulated these things with your whole hand. You didn't use a stick because it was flat.
Yes, it was flat. It didn't need any stick. You see, the figure could be as movable as you like. When you make a figure for shadow playing, you can have not more than two sticks for, you could have, but you mostly wouldn't have more than two sticks for a figure, so you must construct the figure so that puts two sticks to get a maximum of movement, whilst the silhouette figure can have as many joints as it pleases, you see.
So you haven't really changed at all in your techniques from the time of the 20s?
No. I tried to perfection. I tried to get better and better in my movement, and it came easier to me, you see. I had to learn it, but I still don't think I have reached the point of complete perfection. After each film, I think.
When did you make your last film?
I did make my last film. I make them in color now. And the last thing was I made for the pantomime in Coventry 2 years ago. They have this pantomime and they always let me do little interludes. I did the Frog Prince, and this was Cinderella's drive to the ball, you see, fantastic. When Cinderella gets into the coach, she gets in there in her simple dress and goes to the top of the rainbow, and there she gets her dress there, and there she gets her coach there, and then they drive to the ball. A terrible thing to do, you see, with six horses, and each horse has four legs. It's very deplorable.
Well, now, you used to work with your husband closely as a team before he died. How many years did you work together in?
Well, with interruptions, you see. He deserted me occasionally to and went to France and worked with Renoir. But when we had 42 years, I guess, quite a thing.
How much did he work with Renoir? He was his right-hand man, or was he co-director, actually?
Well, it can't be. When we came with the film Prince Ahmed to Paris, we met Renoir in a kind of press déjeuner, and we became great friends on first sight, you see, and we tried to see as much as we could of each other, and we had the same interest. Renoir by this time was experimenting with films, and we were experimenting with films. And we always tried to work together best we could and see as much as we could. He and they came to us to Berlin and we went there. And then my husband worked with him on the film Madame Bovary. Those two men understood each other exceedingly well. This was a very rare kind of friendship. And then when Renoir was making La Grande Illusion, he called my husband over for the German doings and the German uniforms and the German scenes. And he helped Renoir with the script. They were always together, you see. And then I had to travel on here alone.
When your husband wasn't around, you were busy working, of course, creating your next illusion. Your own grand illusion.
Well, my setup is very simple. And once the thing is set up, you easily can do it, you see. You need not having great technical problems, unless you try something new. Then when I try to make films in color and so.
The other day I saw the little film, the Mozart film.
The Papageno.
Papageno. And it was charming, in black and white, but with the music from the Magic Flute. Now, how long would it have taken you to cut out these figures and to prepare the figures? How would you have gone about it, and where were you working at the time?
Well, this time I was working in my studio happily in Berlin, and I had a craze for the Magic Flute all my life, so you see. And with a sound film, as you could be sure that you would have their music, you could. I'm particularly fond of Mozart, And I had made a film on Mozart's music before that, and then I said I would like to make the Papageno of the Magic Flute and everything. But he said it couldn't be done. Now I had a young musician here there in Berlin who was bold enough to arrange a thing for me in a convenient way, where you couldn't do it in the big opera way, so we, for your sound films, the sound was always the most expensive part of doing the things. And we conjured up the story together and made the soundtrack, and then I moved the picture to the soundtrack. For there, the film became more a kind of ballet, you see. You had to follow the music exactly. And I loved doing that film, and I'm very, very pleased that he has survived any of my other doings so well.
There are thousands and thousands of separate movements and separate frames.
Yes, this was a sound film. It is so you have to make 24 frames for each second in time. For if you play the sound slower or quicker, it squeaks or it groans.
And there are how many frames in the whole thing then?
In the whole thing, this would be 15,000. Yes, it sounds terrible. It's not so useful.
And you manipulate each frame. There's a slightly different movement for each frame, or something
This is my. Well, if you, sometimes you have a stop, but you see the stop counts as a movement, and you always stop as a thing. But sometimes you, sometimes for a very slow movement, I take two frames for each. But I'm told this is silly, and one could be much more economical. But I'm not. I believe in that.
The other day at the Unicorn, I saw a shadow play done behind a screen with the sticks in this Chinese tradition that you told me about. How much of this do you do? I saw the story of the 17 card.
Yes, the story of the 17 card. I've always had little shadow tears around me of all sizes and prices, but I had smaller ones. But then I was asked to make a shadow play here for a certain performance, and so I constructed myself, it should be in a theater, and so I constructed myself a biggish theater, and this was the first story I tried out on that. But I like doing that. I like playing directly, you see. I like to play the thing over and over and over again.
How many other people then do you have to involve in putting on this?
In this theater of that size, you have at least to have two more people.
And isn't there a lot of skill in manipulating?
It ought to. For I have not arrived at the thing yet. I do it very primitively. But one can do it much better. One can have wonderful effects with that.
Like what?
One can get out of this is moving the figures, with it. One can get out quite an astounding variety of movement.
When I went back behind the screen, I noticed that the figures were quite enormous, much bigger than I thought they would be, of course, on the screen.
With the films you can have very small figures, but with the enlargement of the projector, they appear very big on the screen. But when you have your shadow theater, you have to have the figures that size. When you do it in a big theater, actually a shadow theater shouldn't have more than 100 spectators, but this is not a paying proposition. In a theater with 300, you have to have bigger figures.
What kind of tales do you really enjoy best? There were two very different things. One was a science fiction story, and the other was a pure folk tale, charming tale about 17 cows. Now, which sort of thing do you prefer? Then there are the magical fantasy things that are, again, quite different.
Yes, well, I like folk tales. I like folk tales very much. I would like to do fables and things for when you, this depends, you if you work for children, the children can't have the play too long. You must have a very obvious thing. I think the next thing I will do will be some fables or so. But the length of the 17 cows is just all right.
Where do you get your tales from?
Oh, I know a lot, you see. I have always loved these old tales, and I'm a great reader of fairy tales of all countries, you see, of all things. And I think they are the most a very good source, you see, for there's a certain truth in these fairy tales, much more truth than in a cowboy story or anything, you see.
So that you actually base most of your subjects on actual sources of folk tales rather than making them up yourself?
Yes, they're better than what I make up myself.
Now, what about the audience? You're talking about children. Do you like working for children?
Yes, very much.
Why?
They're innocent. They're innocent. They are not spoiled by anything. They have a direct approach. And they are a very critical audience. You can't fool around with grown-ups, or you can't fool around with children. I like it very much. I like the look of them when they have seen it. And so I like working for children very much.
But there's sort of a separation between you and the children, unfortunately, because there's a screen up there and you're behind running your puppets.
I always wanted to peep around and see them, you see, so to see what's facing. But you can do either, the one thing. You can't have the cake and eat it too. Eh? When I have a film, of course, I can sit there and watch my audience. I like that very much.
Well, here in this little community where you live, it's sort of an artist community, to what extent do the people in this community know about your work and enjoy it?
Oh, yes. They are quite fond of me and my foolish doings. And they help me a great lot. I couldn't have built up that theater, and so I'm not good at hammering and doing these things, but they are all very, very willing to help me. They are very sweet people.
Do you ever entertain the children around here?
Oh, yes, very much. I have a tiny little theater, and so, well, the children in the moment, they are a little too small. They are no longer 3 years old, and so I haven't had them there, but usually I give quite children of my friends, when they come, they want to see a show. I have my tiny little theater, which is only
A foot by 9 inches,
and they like it. And I do it with candlelight and colored figures, and they like that very much. It's mysterious for them. And this I can do alone, you see. I can play the things alone to them. They like this very much. And then they make me figures, or they send me drawings of the things and so on.
What are you doing now? What is your sort of dream of what you would really like to do, the most splendid thing?
Oh, I had so many dreams which didn't come true. In the moment, I will be quite content to make another little shadow play of another little fable and do that. I'm quite happy with that. I always wanted, my dream was to make the Greek fairy stories, the Greek Metamorphoses, the great fables of Persephone and this kind of thing. And I was very near to that. I got a contract for it, and it was happy as a bird. And then with my husband's death, this all fell into the water. So I have to console myself.
Have you done any work on that? Have you done the research, or have you done any preparation for it?
Yes. I have, since 1936, I'm working on that. This was a dream of mine. And when it came true, my husband died. We were so happy about it. But then he fell ill, and we had the feeling we can't do it, and I don't want to do it alone. Perhaps I do some of those stories as a shadow play.
You could do a part of this, possibly, but not the whole. It's a huge undertaking.
Yes, well, when you make films for television, the only thing which would be, you always have to make 13 films, you see. So you have to have 13 stories and so. And I don't know whether I will live long enough to make these 13 stories, so I just content myself as one.
Thank you.
I'm
afraid I haven't kept them all.
Lottie,
you've done all sorts of things. You've moved from the black and white silence, you've moved into the sound, and then you've moved into color, and then into television even. You worked for the BBC, did you, for some time?
Oh yes, quite some. I first did direct shadow shows, as direct shadow plays, and then... direct shadow shows with puppets, and then I built up my trick table and I made them as films. So that's how they did come all over the world, you see. For the direct shadow shows, they couldn't, but the films were shown everywhere in children's hours.
How many films did you make?
Well, for this series, this was a series of 13. all sorts of grim fairy stories and Andersen fairy stories and Perrault and Aesop, even the Grasshopper and the Ant fables and this kind of thing.
So you seem to love the old tales.
Oh, I very much do so. I must have a story which inspires me to do a thing, a story which I desire to illustrate, which I don't want to get lost, like the story of the Grasshopper in the End. I like that story very much.
What is that story?
The Grasshopper in the End? That is an Aesop fable. That is a grasshopper who amuses the whole, fills the other animals with playing his fiddle all the summer. And then the ant comes and said, "You should be careful, grasshopper. You should gather food and all things for winter will come." And he said, "Oh, no, there's not a cloud in the sky." And the ant said, "You will see, grasshopper, you will see." And then really winter comes and poor grasshopper is cold and has nothing to eat and is cold. And then he passes Mrs. Ant's house, and she sits there comfortably in her house, and he begs for some coffee, and she doesn't give him anything. And then he goes out and freezes, but then freezes. And then the other animals, the dormouse and the squirrel, come, and they find their dear grasshopper dead. And then they take him back and say, "He has been so nice and has been playing the fiddle." And out of gratitude, they bring him back, and they warm him up, and then they sit in the sniggle in the cave of the squirrel, and Grasshopper plays his fiddle, and old Mrs. Ant comes out and hears the music inside and knocks at the door, and Grasshopper comes out, and she is very sorry. She said, I was not very nice to you." And he said, "Oh, well, that's all forgotten. Come in. You have been gathering food all the summer. Now you shall dance, you see." And then it ends happily. Actually, in the fable, it ends unhappily. I think Aesop lets his poor grasshopper starve, but I couldn't have that.
You feel that these old tales are important today. Some people would question that this is not what the children want today.
I don't think so. I don't think so. The children are most moved by these tales. I remember when it's a grasshopper, when I play this also as a direct shadow play, and when Grasshopper comes and says, "I don't know," she said, "You would certainly like to come in and have a cup of coffee." And the grasshopper said, "Oh, I don't know how to thank you." And then Miss Ant said, "You will need to, for you won't get any." The children were always, they've always found this a terrible thing, and I think that's a good thing. And they were all very happy when the grasshopper was good again. There are wonderful modern fairy stories and things, you see. Some of them are very good indeed. I think the Borrowers and the Mrs. Poppins, these are wonderful stories. Dr. Doolittle is a wonderful story. They come close to that, for they have the truth behind, you see. They have the... And the children want to be prepared for life. They want to have some truth which helps them. And these truths which are in these fairy stories, they are very good. I don't like sugary fairy stories, which... I like more folk stories. Well, the Grimm's fairy tales, they are folklore. They are not just gentle fairy. People say they are cruel, and so they are. Life is cruel, but children like that. I wouldn't like to emphasize the cruel part of it, and so too much. I don't want to frighten children. But children like a little bit of hardships and things. They like that.
In the 17 Cows the other day, there's a time when everybody falls on each other and they have a fight. And is this usual in your... The children seem to love this fight.
Well, of course, you must have a fight, you see. You must have a fight. For children love to fight as well. They hit each other over the head very hard and so. This can't be helped.
What about humor?
Well, humor there must be. You must make them laugh. You must make them laugh best you can. I am not very good at making people laugh. I make them smile.
Are you an entertainer, really? Is there a lot of the old theater in you?
Oh, yes, I think so.